From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump today is making his first visit to the headquarters of U.S. Central Command and U.S. Special Operations Command in Tampa. He's coming off a weekend away from Washington at his resort in Palm Beach. And it's his comments in an interview that aired last night before the Super Bowl that are getting attention. In particular, this moment in which he defended Russian President Vladimir Putin, even after host Bill O'Reilly called the Russian leader a killer.
He's a killer, though. Putin's a killer.
A lot of killers. We got a lot of killers. Why, you think our country's so innocent? You think our country's so innocent?
I don't know of any government leaders that are killers in America.
Well, take a look at what we've done, too. We've made a lot of mistakes. I've been against the war in Iraq from the beginning.
Yeah, mistakes are different then.
A lot of mistakes, okay, but a lot of people were killed. So a lot of killers around, believe me.
Well, joining us now is NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Hi, Ron.
Hello, Jeremy. Good to be with you.
Good to have you. And I'm just imagining if President Obama had said something like that, Republicans would have railed against him. What's the reaction been to this statement from President Trump?
There's been a good deal of shock. And to start right at the top, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Republican majority in the Senate, distanced himself from these remarks yesterday. And there's really no big rush to embrace the idea that you could equate perhaps mistakes that the United States government made that led to people dying to what Vladimir Putin has done both in his own country and in other countries. And we should say that just last week, our new United Nations ambassador, and that's Nikki Haley, the former governor of South Carolina, appointed by President Trump, said this: the United States continues to condemn and call for an immediate end to the Russian occupation of Crimea. And she went on to attack the Russians for what they have done in eastern Ukraine. So she said we were not going to lift the sanctions. And yet yesterday we heard the president say that he wants to be better friends with Russia, wants to get along with Russia, sees them as an ally.
So more mixed signals on Russia, and we'll keep watching that. Meanwhile, the president's travel ban put on hold by a federal judge on Friday. Trump has gone after the judge, says the judge will be to blame if an attack occurs. The judge, by the way, appointed by President George W. Bush and confirmed 99-0. But, Ron, there's been a talk of a constitutional crisis because of this. Where are we with this?
The tweets from the president yesterday actually went so far as to suggest that the judiciary in general was going to be to blame unless he prevails, the president prevails, in the struggle over this travel ban. And the struggle itself is very much before an emergency panel of three judges in San Francisco who are part of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals out there. And they are considering this temporary restraining order that the judge in Seattle imposed last week. So they have the decision in their hands. We may see the decision even tonight. The plaintiffs have already filed their briefs overnight, and the federal government, the U.S. Justice Department, defending the president, is going to file its briefs by 6 o'clock Eastern time today.
You mentioned Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who was interviewed on CNN yesterday, and on a number of issues, including the one you mentioned, he did not vigorously defend Trump. He declined to say he would support congressional legislation instituting the ban. Let's listen.
Let me just say, I think proper vetting is important to the American people, but there's a fine line here between proper vetting and interfering with the kind of travel or suggesting some kind of religious test. And we need to avoid doing that kind of thing.
Are we starting to see some more pushback from Republicans to the Trump presidency?
The clear point here is that vetting exists. The president has said we need more vetting. We need extreme vetting. Although we have not seen any cases of anybody brought forward who had passed through the existing vetting and then perpetrated some kind of terrorist act in the United States, he continues to portray the situation as one in which people are pouring, and that is his word, pouring into the country who may very well be dangerous and have bad intentions in mind. So a lot of Republicans now are trying to come up with a way to talk about this that separates themselves from the president's position, positioning themselves, of course, with a thought towards what might come out of the courts, including ultimately probably the Supreme Court, with regard to this travel ban.
One more thing, Ron. Everybody's been talking about this Saturday Night Live sketch over the weekend with Melissa McCarthy playing White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer. It's very funny. I encourage people to take a look at it. But one moment in it, Sean Spicer, played by Melissa McCarthy, brought out Kate McKinnon playing Trump's pick for Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos. And here she is responding to a question from a reporter.
Yes, I don't know anything about school, but I do think there should be a school, probably Jesus School, and I do think it should have walls and roof and gun for potential grizzly.
Playing off a moment there that actually happened in a Senate hearing where she talked about a gun for potential grizzly at a school out west. Ron, the Senate's going to vote on whether DeVos will be confirmed tomorrow. What are you expecting?
At this point, it's still a tie vote, 50-50. That means Vice President Mike Pence is constitutionally empowered to come in and break that tie. Obviously, he will vote for DeVos.
Which means even though there are two Republican senators who've come out and said they'll vote against, she would still be confirmed.
That is correct.
NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent Ron Elving. Ron, thanks.
Thank you, Jeremy.
The Pacific Northwest has a new tsunami survival option, and it could eventually double as a hurricane survival option for people elsewhere. All you have to do is climb into a spherical aluminum pod for what's sure to be the ride of your life, but it might save your life. Tom Bonsi from the Northwest News Network sent this story.
Jeannie Johnson just recently moved from the Seattle area to what she calls her dream home at the beach. It's about midway up the sandy, flat Long Beach Peninsula in southwest Washington state.
When I decided to move to the ocean, into a tsunami zone, I felt like I should prepare.
Geologic records show the Cascadia earthquake fault offshore is capable of generating massive tsunamis. In that case, Johnson's evacuation options are not good. She could make a run for high ground, but this Microsoft executive doubts she could reach safety in the short time between the end of the shaking of a great earthquake and incoming tsunami waves.
People panic, and I don't want to be caught in the panic.
A bit of internet research led her to a new option, a bright orange, high-strength floating metal ball. She's taken delivery and is now deciding whether to tether her capsule in her herb garden or keep it in the garage. In any case, Johnson wants her dog to join her if and when the big one comes.
Trixie, hop. Come on, baby. Hop. Let's go. Let's go. Hop. Good girl.
My model is big enough for two people to be buckled in like a pilot seat.
So that you're going to get into this sphere.
Yeah.
And it looks to me a little bit like an astronaut capsule, actually.
It does. It looks a little bit like it came from NASA.
The aircraft-grade aluminum sphere is about 4.5 feet in diameter. It has a round marine door and two tiny portholes. Inside, drinking water and air supply tanks come standard. A dry powder toilet is an optional feature.
And I have friends who say, oh my God, wouldn't it be claustrophobic? How can you stand it? And all I can think is, what's my option? To drown. I would rather be in that ball for the ride of my life and maintain my life.
Johnson is the first domestic customer of a startup called Survival Capsule, based near Seattle. Company president Julian Sharp says he got the idea for the product lying awake one night while weekending at a beach town in Oregon.
I thought, well, what happens now if a tsunami comes?
The aerospace engineer had a brainstorm.
And I just thought, well, it's going to be a disaster because I've got four sleeping kids. If it comes at night, lights are going to be out. You know, you don't necessarily know where you're going. You can't see the wave, how far it is. So I thought it would be great if I had something I could design, throw the family in and ride it out. And that's where it all started.
Sharp's company's initial sales have been to Japanese customers, 8 capsule kits so far. He anticipates local governments in Japan could become a major customer base, along with private sales to Americans living along the West Coast, Gulf Coast, and East Coast. While the inspiration for the product was tsunami survival, Sharp says his company's capsules are now drawing additional interest from people worried about hurricanes.
Rather than evacuate from hurricanes and be 200 miles away while the hurricane decides it wants to go in a different direction, leaving their home vulnerable or business vulnerable to looting, they want to stay at home, have a tsunami capsule as a last line of defense.
At this point, you might wonder how much this peace of mind costs. Sharp says the two-person survival capsule starts at $13,500. A four-person model lists for $17,500. Residents who swung by Long Beach, Washington City Hall recently to look at plans for a different evacuation option had mixed reactions to the tsunami capsule idea. Jane Benna shivers at the prospect of sheltering inside while being battered by tsunami debris.
I would hate to be bounced around in that. I'm too old. I'm 80 years old. I don't know that I would care to survive a tsunami.
The city of Long Beach is using grant money to design an armored man-made hill that could be used as a tsunami evacuation platform for at least 850 people. Benna favors building that, but as you maybe can tell, she's fatalistic about her own chances of survival. For Here and Now, I'm Tom Bontsey in Ocean Park, Washington.
The National Museum of African American History and Culture is one of the hottest tickets in Washington, D.C. Hundreds of thousands have visited since its September opening. Demand for advance passes has at times overwhelmed the online ticketing system. And while most museums tend to have a linger time of about 2 hours, people linger in the African American Museum for up to six. Because it's fun, there's the impact of African Americans on popular culture, but also because it's devastating. Exhibits on slave ships and lynching shake people to their core.
And that's why it's Sweet Home Cafe. You know, you always find that refuge going home and getting the comforting things, you know, whether it's going home to see your mother and you're comforted by her. You know, here we've made this a home for everybody to come in. You know, that you see some things that shaking you up, and we want to comfort you through our stories, through our food, and we want you to come to our dinner tables and sit just like you're at home seeking that refuge.
That's Jerome Grant, executive chef of the museum's restaurant, the Sweet Home Cafe.
I mean, you know, for us, we look at our cafe as an edible exhibit. It's very important with all the greatness that we have in the building. You know, it makes us step our game up 20 times higher because we need to be just as notable as, you know, our sports end that we have upstairs, as well as, you know, our Emmett Till exhibit and things like that, our Foodways exhibit. You know, we have to coincide with that and put forth just as much awesomeness that they all have.
The cafe is owned and operated by Restaurant Associates, along with Thompson Hospitality, the largest black-owned food service company in America. We met up with Chef Grant in the large kitchen next to trays of sweet potatoes and pecan pie and talked about the scholars involved in making this all happen.
So, lots of history and the eyes of just about all of Black America on you. No pressure.
Oh, yeah. No pressure at all, right? You know, for me, this has been a goal of mine for the past couple of years. I was at the American Indian Museum prior to. I came on as a sous chef, and when I found out that we would be bidding on this contract, I set it as my goal. To be the chef here at the African-American Museum as my goal. And, you know, I really stuck to it, refined my skills as far as serving cultural centers and doing right by the culture themselves. We've researched and done a ton of research. You know, we've had a really awesome team, Dr. Jessica Harris, who helped us with the opening, as well as our supervising chef, Albert Lucas, that really helped devise the game plan for us here at Sweet Home Cafe. And we've identified these stories within these regions and put great food behind them.
It has to be right. It has to be authentic.
Oh, yes, it has to be authentic, but it has to be done with love and soul. You know, we all have to believe what's going on, and we all have to have that buy-in. And the great thing about our people here is that we all understand how big of a deal this place is and how we really honor it, you know.
Let's go into the dining area.
We make our way past sous chefs and a kitchen apprentice and...
Oh, my gosh. We're walking by some beautiful pies. What are we seeing here in the kitchen?
Well, over here, we're working on a production for tomorrow. We get a lot of kids that come in, so we're actually working on fried macaroni and cheese balls for the kids. Again, taking something comforting that kids could identify with, somewhat modernizing it and giving them, you know, a new modern-day play on it. You know, we have our greens, which here, you know, we really take the time to bring in whole leaves. We butcher them ourselves. We cut them down. We braise them for 2 hours, you know. Everything here is done just like you do it at home.
What's the fish in front of us?
The fish that we have in front of us is our cornbread and mustard green stuffed trout that we feature on the Western Range, which the Western Range is a region that we've identified that a lot of people don't identify with African-American migration.
In the vast cafeteria-style dining area, Chef Grant answers questions from a mother and child from Texas who really want that stuffed trout.
Yes. So over here you can do the pulled pork over here without the bread, as well as we have various sides like collard greens. We have various salads. We have a benne seed and a arugula salad. We have potato salad, coleslaw.
That looks appetizing.
Yeah. Actually, get with one of the servers, and then they might be able to cook you one in the back.
He's a chef.
Yeah.
Then Chef Grant gives us a primer on the serving stations.
Yes, so what we have, we've identified four regions of the migration of African Americans throughout the United States. Pre-slavery and post-slavery. We have the Creole Coast, which we kind of view as an entry point.
Creole Coast.
Yes. So you'll see a lot of French Creole style food, shrimp and grits. We do our catfish po' boy. We do our andouille and crawfish gumbo, as well as with the little duck in there. It tells these cool stories. Then we have our northern states where, a lot of African Americans migrated to the north for freedom via the Underground Railroad. Over there, you'll find our oyster pan roach, which is inspired by Thomas Downing, which is a great story in itself because Thomas Downing was a son of freed slaves from Virginia who went up to New York City. And what he ended up doing was he was a oyster harvester at first, and he would sell oysters to taverns. Then he went ahead and said, I might as well open up my own tavern. Opened up his tavern, and, before the Grand Central Station days, literally people would line up around the blocks for his oysters. But at the same time, his oyster tavern doubled as a stop on the Underground Railroad. So it goes to show you something as simple as, a meal really ties into a lot,
How do you do the oysters?
So it's a quick saute with butter. We add a little bit of chili sauce, heavy cream, white wine, Worcester sauce, and reduce it down to almost like a creamy consistency, and then serve it with a toast.
So that's the north.
Yep. And then we have our agricultural south, which is, southern comfort food. You get our three-day buttermilk brine chicken. You get Brunswick stew from the Carolinas. You get a really nice Lexican-style barbecue pork sandwich. And as well as we feature our gullah-style Hoppin' John from, Charleston, where we're actually able to get Red Island sea peas and actually do it the traditional way.
You said a couple things. So Hoppin' John, yes. That is?
Hoppin' John is rice and peas.
Po' boy?
Po' boy is actually a fried fish sandwich that comes with remoulade sauce, lettuce, tomato, and pickle. Where we actually do a green bean pickle here.
So what happens, Chef? Do you have people who come in and I'm sure you're out on the floor a lot. Do you have people who you see going, oh, this is home? Or do you have people saying, as you just said, my grandmother just did not do it this way?
We get everything. I mean, at the end of the day, we want people to feel like this is home. A lot of people come in here and feel like this is home and appreciate what we're doing. But at the same time, there's always, my grandmother did it this way. And, that's what's to be expected. That's a part of our industry, and that's a part of what we've created here. Again, we've created those conversations. We've engaged in those conversations. And for us, it's great because, A, we know how we're doing, and, B, we could always fix things and figure that out to where, all our guests will enjoy. And the feedback's much needed, whether positive or negative. That's the only way that our business will grow and our meals will grow and we can continue to grow these stories.
So I'm counting. We had the coast, the north, the south.
And then we have the Western Range, which is actually my favorite station. So the Western Range, we feature Son of Gun Stew, which is another awesome story in itself. After slavery, African Americans migrated to the West for new beginnings. A lot of the jobs out there were actually, chuck wagon cooks. So a lot of blacks became chuck wagon cooks and would cook for the railroad workers, cowboys, and it was just, a cultural mixing pot of people out west. So over here, you'll see good hints of, Native American cuisine, Latin cuisine, as well as even Asian cuisine, because, as immigrants came over, they helped build the railroads. They migrated more towards the west.
Well, so you pick up out when you do the Western Range section, you've got the influence of across the border, Mexico, and that kind of cooking. But overall, as I look up here, it says marriage of traditional African-American cooking techniques with flavors and ingredients of the West. What would you say that, what's an African-American cooking technique?
African-American cooking techniques, to me, are American cooking techniques. Whether we were slaves or indentured servants, a lot of the meals were done by African-Americans throughout the United States. A lot of these African-American cooks and chefs were all classically French-trained. We've taken those traditions, came to the States and made them our own by whether it was, cast iron cooking, slow and low cooking. We've been able to do that and adapt to the areas that we're in to bring these dishes out.
You say something, it's such a reminder. Africans and then African-Americans, we're the country's cooks.
Yes, I truly believe that. I mean, there's been research done to where, during the slave trade, there were different classifications of slaves. In the cooking field, there was a pastry cook. There was, you know, just an honest, straightforward cook. And then as well as there was more of like a modern-day early cook, you know, a young cook. And they were all sold at different prices. And it goes to show you that, you know, the skilled hands did get a better price and also were the ones that did all this cooking. You know, they viewed African-Americans as, you know, tremendous cooks, great cooks.
Chef, I couldn't help but just notice something. When you came to the sentence, they were sold at separate prices, you almost flinched a little.
It's, for me, it's difficult to tell stories like that. But the great thing is, you know, I have food to show our resilience and to show where we come from.
Well, when you say it's difficult to hear that, you're in this building where that's what this building houses. Does it ever get painful, you know, to...
For me, I haven't taken the time to go through the building fully.
Really?
It's difficult for me. I grew up in a very awesome household, you know, of mixed races. You know, I've always found it hard to really stomach those types of things. And for me, you know, I take it time by time. You know, the first time that I really went through the history gallery downstairs was actually 3 weeks ago, where I've fully seen a lot of stuff that's really heartbreaking and very difficult to digest.
Like if you don't mind, like what? Like...
I've seen some of the slave ship pictures, the railroads. I mean, everything from shackles, the whole nine. Like, it's difficult, you know. It's difficult to know that we live in a world where, you know, we're deemed to be free Americans. And then to see that it was, you know, very troubling for a lot of us to
how recently?
Oh yeah. So it's very difficult. But at the end of the day, you know, you can't understand your future unless you understand your past. And I'm working on it.
Our visit with Jerome Grant, executive chef of the Sweet Home Cafe inside the National African American Museum of History and Culture in Washington, D.C. You can find a link to some of the dishes we talked about and some pictures, and you can share some of your favorite traditional African American meals at hereandnow.org.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Poo-Pourri, the original Before You Go Toilet Spray, that uses essential oils to trap bathroom odor beneath the surface of the water. Use it next time you have to go at work or when visiting family and friends. Poo-Pourri allows you to go anywhere with uplifting, natural fragrances like lemongrass, lavender, or hibiscus. Whether at work, on a date, even at a party, you can go. Use the code NOW and get 20% off your next purchase at poopourri.com.
Today is the first full day of trading after President Donald Trump directed the U.S. Treasury to review the 2010 financial reform bill known as Dodd-Frank. Trump called Dodd-Frank a disaster and vowed to cut a lot of the regulations put in place after the 2008 financial crisis. One of those was a pending rule known as the fiduciary standard, which required retirement advisors to put the interests of their clients first. For more, we're joined by Jill Schlesinger of CBS News. She's host of Jill on Money and the podcast Better Off. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So one of the things President Trump did with his executive order on Friday was to stop the implementation of that fiduciary rule. Just remind us what that would have done.
Well, the fiduciary is a standard of care that requires financial professionals to put the interests of their clients first. This rule was just for retirement accounts, so it was a Department of Labor rule. It was set to go into effect in April, and it meant that any person or firm that touched a retirement investor had to adhere to the fiduciary standard, and if they didn't, they had to go through kind of lots of hoops to disclose why they weren't complying with the fiduciary standard.
And many already do this. So how much of a difference does it make if the government doesn't require them to do this?
Well, you know, it was the first time we were going to see the government take action on this. You're absolutely right. There are probably about 80,000 different financial professionals, whether they're CFPs or CPAs or CFAs, all different designations, who do adhere to the fiduciary standard. But this would be the first time in the history of investor protections where it would be mandated. And I think this is important because so many Americans believe that they are working with an advisor or a salesperson or broker who is doing that, who is acting in his or her best interest, But that's not the case. So I think we need to really clearly spell it out, and that's what this rule would have done.
What other financial regulations do you expect this review of Dodd-Frank to strike down or reverse?
Well, I think when it comes to the consumer side, we better be keeping a good focus on the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB. That's likely to come under big review. It could get a new leader, it could get watered down, and it could get defunded. When it comes to the big banks, we're likely to see some changes in the way that the capital requirements are calculated. What does that mean? That means banks had to carry more money, had to keep more money on hand, more collateral, if you will, in case something really bad happened. And those capital requirements were pretty steep. They were very different prior to the crisis. And some say that if the banks had more money on hand, then we wouldn't have gotten to the edge, the precipice of disaster when it came to the 2008 financial crisis.
Well, and weren't they needed at that time because the banks didn't have enough money?
Well, they didn't. Look, the critics of Dodd-Frank say that, yes, it's great to have them be forced to have more capital on hand, but there are critics on both sides. One says that Dodd-Frank didn't go far enough, that, in fact, the banks are still so big, so interconnected, right, that they really are still a problem. They are too big to fail. And on the other side, they say, oh, you know what, you're really hurting banks and their ability to do business with all these rigorous rules that are in place.
Well, and we're already seeing a story in the Wall Street Journal today that says the six biggest U.S. banks could potentially return more than $100 billion to investors if they're no longer required to set aside so much for stress tests. A lot to watch. Jill Schlesinger, host of Jill on Money and the podcast Better Off. Thanks so much.
Take care.
At least 57,000 college students are homeless, according to tallies from educators. And it's coast to coast. The University of California system said last year that about 1 in 10 of its students was homeless. 1 in 5 didn't have enough to eat. And a recent survey of Massachusetts colleges shows nearly half had an increase in homeless students in the past year. Here now's Peter O'Dowd visited one campus.
I want to go everywhere. Mr. Tom, what's going on, my brother?
How you doing, man?
You're a popular guy.
I am. Yeah.
Lorenz Marsalis is the kind of student who struts through a busy college campus with confidence. But the senior at Bridgewater State University in eastern Massachusetts isn't a typical student. He moved here from Haiti at 14. When he was a high school senior, his father ran out of money to pay the rent. So the lanky, gregarious teenager moved with his family into a motel and eventually into a homeless shelter.
And I remember after school thinking, where am I going to sleep tonight, kind of thing. And it wasn't easy. It was hard on me mentally.
Marsalis excelled at school against the odds. Research shows the stress of homelessness and hunger wreaks havoc on a student's performance. So I asked Marsalis to take me to one of two food banks at Bridgewater State. It's where we met campus minister Marlene De Leon.
Here it is. It's not big.
Actually, the food bank is tiny, just a few shelves tucked away in a corner at the Catholic Center.
We got some, looks like some bags of pasta here and
pasta.
Standard fare for a college campus.
Very popular. Right? Also popular is this cold cereal up there. Not that I think that's the best nutritious breakfast, but that's what students like. You can see corn. We have lots of canned vegetables.
Some cut yams, some green beans, some black beans. Right. Tell me about the need.
So on campus, the need has increased. Most students here work. I would say 95% of the students work probably at least 20 hours a week. And that's to pay for all of their expenses of school, but also a car. And they may run out. So they come here and they supplement what they're doing for their own food with the food here.
So the students going here, there's a gap between what they can make and what they get in aid. There's often, you're saying, there's just still not enough.
Correct, correct. And you also have students who may be homeless. They may have been foster children. They're now at an age where they're no longer cared for by a parent or a guardian. Some of the students don't have any housing and have to be here during vacation. They need food during that vacation.
Before I met Lorenz, I didn't often think about college kids and homelessness. You don't often put the two together, but you're saying that it is a real problem.
It's a reality, yes. And it's a hidden reality.
And it's a reality that researchers are trying to learn more about. The problem appears to be growing, along with tuition rates, student debt, and the cost of living in American cities.
There's a lot more need out there.
Michelle Wakin runs the Bridgewater Scholars Program, which gives up to two high-achieving students like Lorenz Marcellus a scholarship to cover tuition and living expenses. At some point in their lives, Wakin says every student on the scholarship has been homeless.
Defining what homelessness is really difficult. It's episodic. You never know when it's going to hit your family or for how long it's going to hit or whether it's going to mean, you know, couch surfing.
I met a few of Wakin scholars who know very well what it's like.
My story, I came from my country, Kiverd, when I was 15 years old.
Anna Lobo moved to the United States without her parents and was promptly kicked out of her sister's house when Lobo told her she was pregnant.
We lived a few months in a basement.
And then moved to a shelter.
And I stayed there for like 8 years.
And so you raised your baby there?
Yes. We went there when she was 6 months. That's when they started supporting us with the school. It was hard for me because of the language. And I had dropped out of school when I was like probably 10 years old in Kiverd. And coming back to school was pretty hard. And with the speaking a different language, it was worse. But I got through it, and I got my diploma.
Wow. So what made you decide that you were going to come to college?
My daughter. After I gave birth to her, I had to take a big decision, which was find a better life for her and for me.
Now 27, Lobo wears a big smile and trendy glasses. She's about to graduate with a degree in social work. Next to her is junior Zachary Wright, a math major. He also lived in a shelter for a few months one summer after his mother fled an abusive relationship.
It's a small place. There's like no air conditioning. There's nothing to do around there. It's really hot.
7 months later, they got out of the shelter on Cape Cod when Wright's mother found them a new place to live.
So things at that time were looking up. I was doing what I needed to do. I was getting good grades. And then one of the most unexpected things to happen to me happened, which was when I was 16, my mother passed away. And, you know, I didn't have a father. And my stepfather wasn't with us. For some time, I was just by myself with my brother. You know, it's really hard when you have had one, like, main pillar of support for most of your life, and then they just disappear. So.
I'm so sorry to hear that story. What happened after your mother died? You said your brother was around. I mean, where were you guys staying at that point?
So my brother was also in high school with me. Mm-hmm. So we were alone in our housing that we had gotten for a little while. Until my sister, she was offering to, you know, take us in. She was someone I hadn't seen, like, ever since I was young. So I didn't really have that great relationship with her at that time.
But you knew. So just like everybody else, you knew the way out of this was by going to school, right? I mean, but how did you know that? I mean, how did you have the presence of mind to even know that?
Well, first and foremost, like, public education, it's free. So for me, that's like a prime opportunity. You need to just take it because really it's, you know, the foundation to ending poverty in my eyes.
Yeah. Sure, but somebody had to teach you that. I mean, somebody was a good enough influence on you to sort of tell you that at some point, I guess. Or did that something that come from inside of you, do you think?
I think a part of it was in it, but, you know, my mom was always hammering me that into me. Ever since I was little.
Wright is shy, but smart. His GPA, nearly perfect. And his story hit a nerve around the table. Because the students here know what it's like to have a safety net that's threadbare. For them, the difference between failure and success might be nothing more than a memory of a loved one. That's the way it is for Nayara Semedo, a formerly homeless freshman whose mother lives thousands of miles away on the west coast of Africa.
I feel like it's different when you hear other people's stories because you think you've been through it all. You think you've hit rock bottom until you hear other people's struggles, you know. I always felt like I was different from my friends because they never been through what I have. They always had, they always had their parents, their mom and dad to help them with everything. And me, it was just me. And now it feels like I belong because I'm not the only one who has been through what I have. There's different people who, you know, have been through worse. And in a way, it feels good because you know you're not by yourself, you know.
You're not, and you're making it, by the way. I mean, you're doing the work. You're getting through it.
Yeah.
There you go. This is my room.
Before I left Bridgewater, I asked Lorenz Marcellus to show me his apartment. It's typical. He's pinned a Haitian flag on the wall next to a poster of Bob Marley. And it's not lost on him that in a few months he'll need a job and that he'll be leaving the safety of this home.
Knowing that I'm going to be doing that is kind of scary, and not knowing the next step, so to speak.
Yeah. What kind of perspective do you think you have on life at 23 that most people don't?
For me, it's being humble. It's one thing to hear about homelessness. It's another thing to experience it. I mean, I was humble before, but, you know, that really humbled me more.
Humbled, but determined not to look back. For Here and Now, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
People dealing with opioid addiction sometimes end up in a hospital emergency room because of an overdose. But treating addiction goes far beyond that, and it's placing a heavy burden on hospitals. Jack Rodolico from Here and Now contributor New Hampshire Public Radio has our story.
Catholic Medical Center in Manchester, New Hampshire is your typical big city hospital. They deliver babies, set broken bones, perform heart surgery. It might be as good a place as any to witness how the opioid crisis can transform healthcare.
We're on the ground floor of the hospital, and we're walking through the radiology department to the back door of the emergency department.
Dr. William Goodman is the chief medical officer here, and he's our tour guide today.
You know, as your doctor, you sit around and you tell sort of like your war stories.
The first person he introduces me to is an ER doctor named Rory Simmons. She's practiced medicine in tough places. She's treated heroin addicts in Ireland and people with HIV in South Africa.
And the worst stories I can think of from here in New Hampshire are related to opioid addiction, by far. I have never seen anything like this. I cannot overstate it enough. It is overwhelming, out of control. This is a tidal wave. This is the worst of the worst I've ever seen of anything anywhere.
New Hampshire hospitals are seeing more and more people addicted to opioids. In ERs alone last year, there were 6,000 patients statewide, with more than 1,000 being treated right here at Catholic. Most patients are in their 20s and 30s, but there are newborns and the elderly here, too. Some overdose in the field, then die in the emergency room. Others have serious infections from injecting heroin with dirty needles. Other times, hospital staff are surprised to learn a patient who's sick is also addicted, says Dr. Goodman.
So we'll have someone who has a bowel problem or a heart problem or the diabetes is out of control, and they're addicted to an opioid.
As I'm talking with Dr. Simmons, I notice a sign on the wall behind her. In so many words, it warns opioid addicts they shouldn't try to trick doctors into prescribing them narcotics.
When somebody comes in and says, I have lower back pain, your first inside gut reaction is, I'm not giving you painkiller. It's not...
You sort of start from a place of mistrust.
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure.
Next, Dr. Goodman, my guide, takes me upstairs to the intensive care unit. About 40% of opioid addicts who come to the ER here are sick enough to be admitted to the hospital, and a lot wind up in intensive care. Some survive overdoses, but are brain dead. Others are wheeled here to recover from surgeries for infections caused by their drug use. Tracy Fahey has been a nurse at Catholic for 22 years. Fahey says that mistrust of patients addicted to opioids has made her quicker to call security.
So I think we put up our guard a little bit. And then we also can have the family members, friends, so-called friends, also searched so that it's the safety of the nurse.
Think about that. Searching the friends and families of patients. Treating addiction in a hospital just seems to erode trust between doctors and nurses and their patients. One wing of the hospital that has a lot of success with patients addicted to opioids is the special care nursery. That's where I'm introduced to Dr. William Edwards, a neonatologist.
My role is generally taking care of babies with problems.
Edward says for years, babies born addicted were treated in critical care units, which are these overstimulating environments.
It's taken quite a while for us to actually figure out that that's probably the worst place to manage withdrawal symptoms.
Now, Catholic treats these babies in rooms like the one we're standing in. One bed for mom, one for baby. It's warm and quiet. Once they're here, some babies get morphine to wean off their addiction, but a lot do better without the morphine. Instead, they get a sort of cuddling protocol.
Being held skin to skin, being talked to, sung to, fed. It's pretty simple.
Here's what's not simple about treating all these patients. A hospital can fix the infection or get you through detox. It can't help patients navigate their addiction after they're discharged, which is why so many patients come back again and again. And that's forced another big change at Catholic. Hospital staff are working with first responders and treatment centers throughout the city to create a safety net. Dr. Goodman says the goal is to make the hospital a step along the path of addiction treatment, not a revolving door for people who can't get healthy.
Never did I dream that in my quest to reduce disease and suffering, would I be on the first name basis with the chief of police, the attorney general, the mayor. But this problem is so complex, you can't just treat it from in the hospital because you're downstream and it's too late.
Goodman says he'll know the state has turned the tide when fewer opioid addicts are coming through the door and when the ones that do come through can continue healing when they leave. For Here and Now, I'm Jack Rodolico, reporting from Manchester, New Hampshire.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.